Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am honored to share the microphone with the most interesting business leaders who have wonderful stories to share and who are excited to freely share their journeys, their business wisdom, tips, and actionable advice. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. In fact, my guests are so compelling and so insightful that this podcast was recently written up on Inc.com as one of the best business podcasts you need to be listening to now and has been mentioned on Entrepreneur and MSNBC. Our topic today, the $1 million payday with Murray Priestley. Murray is a partner at Global Private Partners, a private equity investment firm based in Hong Kong. And since 1988, Murray has provided executive-level management to a range of businesses, working from an in-depth understanding of financial markets, information technology, and customer service. He has bridged the gap between strategy and operational requirements. He's a natural leader, and he acts as a catalyst for rapid growth and execution. Murray is also the author of two books, one of which is The Great Business Shape-Up, and the other one, which is basically what we're going to be talking about today, The $1 Million Payday. Now, this book comes from the perspective, I guess this book and this business comes from the perspective of a private equity investor. How do they look at businesses to buy? What hidden value do they see? And then he turns this around as that hidden value is what needs to be unlocked in order to drive the online business's valuation. And not even online businesses, brick-and-mortar businesses, and make it saleable. Good morning, Murray. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. It is a pleasure to have you here.
Good morning, Denise, and it's fantastic to be with you. And just listening to that introduction, I'd just add lots of gray hair, which just comes from seeing lots of businesses and getting and involved in the trenches, both good and bad. So.
Yeah, I bet.
Gray hair is probably my greatest challenge here.
Well, at least it didn't all fall out, which happens when you're stressed. So you're ahead of the game. Listen, the last time we spoke, you were in Hong Kong, but today you're calling in from Singapore, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, no, I live now in Singapore. So.
Right. And it's evening for you. It's a very early morning for me. But here we are. I mean, I'm so excited that we get to chat. For our audience, we were actually scheduled for yesterday, and we had technical problems. So we rescheduled, and I'm so glad we were able to do that.
Now, and so am I. Yes, the time zones are a little bit different. I'm actually ahead of you, so it's 8 p.m. here.
I know.
And I'm in front of you, so...
You are. Well, listen, before we get started, please tell our audience a bit about yourself that I might have missed.
Look, I guess the, yes, we're in a business where we're lucky enough to have some good investor backing. And, we spend our time looking to acquire companies on the basis of, what can we do with them? You know, companies that are probably not going as well as the owner has hoped, because ultimately we're looking to buy cheap. We have lots of companies that sort of come through our books. They've got to be actually making money, usually in spite of what the owner is doing. And we talk about that more about the sort of things that we look for in a company. But I see a lot of diverse businesses, and I see a lot of huge potential in companies, and we sort of have a view that if we look at sort of five or six different companies and we kind of say we want to basically buy them all or take an investment in all of them, I can see if all five do business with each other, and what the picture looks like if they sort of combine their effort, and what that would look like going to the marketplace. Whereas, of course, most business owners have built their business, they're very myopic. You know, they only see what's in front of them. As we said before, you know, prior to the, you know, the call here, you know, they're generally, you're worried about paying the bills, and they just miss out on seeing the bigger picture. I guess I'm lucky enough where now, you know, we are only looking at companies where we are only focused on the big picture. So we can sort of pick and choose what sort of companies we want to pull into the picture and make sure that they do business with each other. We can make sure that they save money by outsourcing activities. You know, we're going to talk a lot more about virtual assistants and how that can completely revolutionise what companies do. But we see it on a big picture. You know, we own a couple of BPO companies. So we pretty much force all the companies that we take an investment in to use those BPO companies to save money. And, you know, it's good. I'm privileged. I really enjoy what I'm doing, and life is just getting better and better.
It sounds like it. You said something very interesting in the green room, which I've thought about in the last couple of years but did not think about when I was first building my business, and, you know, it goes to that myopia. But you said that businesses should be building with, you know, with the end game being that they'll eventually be sold, so they have a legacy. So many of us simply don't think that way. I mean, we're, you know, building the business, we're scrambling around trying to make sure that everything is done at the end of the day, and of course it never is. And, you know, just like said in the green room, trying to pay the bills, get the staff paid, and wake up to start all over again another day. And many of us don't start our businesses with the eye to making it profitable enough and interesting enough that we can sell it and move away from it. And I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Look, it's definitely, you know, and I've been in both, right? So I can attest to what happens when you try and start a company and you throw all your investment into it, and your time and effort and your stress and worry and all the rest of it, and you just don't have time to sit up and smell the roses, so to speak. But if you know, all the businesses that I've ever seen that have ever worked really well, they've been built from day one to be sold, which means that they don't rely on the owner, they don't rely on a particular personality, they're very systematic. You know, what they do is generally pretty simple. It's repeatable, and it's scalable. And if you kind of stitch those all things together, and that's not the only recipe, of course, but if you stitch that all together, then you as the owner, you know, it's not reliant on you to sort of grow and scale the business. And you know, therefore, it gives you an opportunity to sell it. A lot of businesses, if you think of the corner store, where, you know, it's typically, you know, mum and dad, and, you know, they may involve the kids, but, you know, mum and dad, they work their butt off in order to build and have income. But that business is not really sellable because it relies on them, it relies on what they know. You know, maybe they hired an assistant or two, but those assistants don't run the company. So you've got to be able to, I think, you know, to get the biggest benefit. And when you sell a company, generally that will be the biggest payday you've ever seen. The company can't rely on you. You know, you can't be the only person that does things. It's got to be able to be systemized. It's got to be, you know, either have outsourced or staff that are running things. And by doing that, you've got something that is going to be valuable. And if you just think that way from day one, you will just run the company differently. And generally, I think that gives you a better result.
Immediately, my mind went to ego. We all built these companies. You know, it's our babies. If you're anything like me, you're a high-functioning workaholic. You don't give up tasks easily. I had to really argue with myself in the beginning about how, you know, outsourcing, and look, I'm a virtual assistants industry expert. I was the worst at it when it came to my own company, the worst. And I admit that to anybody. You know, I can help any company, I can help any person, but it was always easy. I'll just do it myself. It's quicker if I just do it myself. And then eventually I was so exhausted that I had to have systems in place or I was killing myself. So how do you get your ego out of the way from day one and that control freak thing that a lot of us have going on?
Look, you know, it's a really good question, and I'm not exactly sure of the answer. A really good friend of mine has a particular plaque that he built, and you know, when you set up your desk and you've got your laptop and your, you know, little external monitor, and he has this plaque above his monitor, and it says, "Will I ever do this again?"
Oh.
Now that's a simple saying. Will I ever do this again? And so if you, whatever you're doing, if the answer is, will I ever do this again? And the answer is yes, then systemize it so you can give it to somebody else. And that's probably the first thing to consider is, why are you doing everything yourself? If you can offload it to somebody else, and you know, even if they only do it 80% as good as you, that's, you're good to go. Get somebody else to do it. And therefore you can start focusing on doing other things, which is generally related to getting more customers. So that'd be the first consideration I'd have.
And, you know, for those of us who are listening to us now and in the future, because this will be downloadable very quickly, you have to get your ego out of the way and you have to get your pride out of the way. And you know what I have found, Murray? I've managed to build this tremendously effective team. And thank goodness I finally pulled my head out of the sky and did that. It's not my first word, but that's the one I'm using. But, you know, what I found is that when I give my team a big picture overview, I hire people or I bring onto my team only people who are really qualified and in some cases more qualified than I am, which is very smart, right? So I give them a big picture view and they're like, hey, Denise, how about if we try it this way? Or did you think of this? So instantly I've gone into a brain trust and I'm able to pull from them some better ideas that I would have had on my own. But you have to get past that, oh, I can just do it myself. It's quicker and easier. It's really not.
You know, it comes to the point about what, you know, what is a true leader. Ego is generally, you know, we all have ego. That's great, but you know, leaders are the people who can motivate, who can instill in others that they will go ahead and do the work, and build the right teams. You know, one of the first things that I think about is that, if there's a task to be done, you know, like we talked about that little saying, you know, will I ever have to do this again? So I might go ahead and use screen grab and show and talk and say, here's the system, here's what I need to do. Then I hand it across to one of the team members and then I said, here's what I think we need to do. Can you improve it?
Right.
And by saying that, you're giving them permission to actually change it. And so that's a leader is saying that. Whereas someone with ego would be to say, okay, here's what I want you to do. Now I'm going to judge you on how well you do it. And
how quickly you do it, which is never right.
Yeah.
You know. Ugh,
and that's
that drives
right.
me crazy.
And you've set up the wrong attitude to start with. Whereas I'd just be happy that somebody else is doing what I was doing. That, you know, that's good enough for me. It's like, okay, even if they're only 50% as good as you, who cares? Because they're probably only getting paid 50% of what you're being paid. So therefore, you know, you're good to go. At least you're not doing it. But the point, if you extend this out and, you know, maybe there's 200 or 300 things that a company would do, then you've got a business that's sellable. Whereas before, you didn't. And that's a huge valuation difference. Huge.
Yeah, I can see that. So before we go into how that would work, why would somebody want to sell their business? And I know that sounds like a bit of a silly question, But it's really not. I mean, there are people like me who build up service, you know, related businesses. And it doesn't occur to us in the early days that we can sell it because we are front-facing. We're the face of the business. We're the ones doing the actual work until we build a team. We're the ones out there doing everything. We're finding clients. We're servicing the clients. We're doing the work. We're building the websites. So it does get a little myopic. So why would we want to sell our business?
Well, the easy answer is it's probably the biggest payday you'd ever see. So that's probably the simple answer. The more complicated answer is that if you take the view that when there's a gold rush, sell pants, right? So people get focused on doing when most of the money is actually made by supporting the people who are doing the doing. And so if you can build up a business that supports a particular niche or whatever it does, you build up this great knowledge, then build it up and sell it, take the payday, go and, relax for 3 months or do whatever you would want to do, but then take the cash and then go build a bigger business and do it again and then sell it again and then take the bigger, take the cash, save some, and then be a bigger business, because ultimately the guys that are really earning a lot, guys, girls, generically the people who are generally making the most difference in other people's lives are not small companies. They're bigger companies. So, use this as a stepping stone to be able to build up. Get to a part where you're 100, 200, 300, 400 staff, then you're definitely in the realm of, you are not doing all the work. And those guys are the ones who are selling for, big numbers. So, to me, that's kind of, I guess, I'm ingrained in that's how I think. And I think that's how you get out of being a small, a small business is a great stepping stone to be a bigger business. That's my thinking.
Is there a mindset that goes along with that? Because my thinking is that could be terribly frightening.
Look, I think there is, but as you said, we've said all the way along here that most people have just never thought of it. So it's yes, I guess any change is frightening. If you've never done it before, it's frightening. That's why people can listen to your podcast. People can get advice and consulting and all the rest of it. But the only reason they're doing that is because they want some advice on something that they've never thought of before. And they take a step up, on that basis. And so as long as you keep taking steps up, you're moving forward and moving forward quickly. Those people who want to just, not think that hard will just stay stuck. So, I think that's the answer. Is just keep moving forward and think more. Take more opportunity to consider, what would it be like if.
Oh, I like that. So when you're looking at businesses, what makes a business valuable to you? What have the owners done that puts them kind of in your line of sight?
They come in various different ways and paths, right? So there's certainly businesses don't really have to advertise the fact that they're for sale. You can word of mouth, you can sort of be targeting different businesses. You can talk to accountants, talk to lawyers, and suddenly you've got more businesses to look at than you have time to spare. But in everything that I've ever seen before, there's a bunch of things that are always never done correctly, and that goes from businesses that are like five people businesses all the way through to one that I work with was 8,500 people. In fact, there's bigger businesses that I've been involved in. They still do it wrong, but they weren't for sale per se. But the ones that were for sale always do this wrong. One is the owner has a particular vision of what they want to achieve, but they keep it a secret. And so nobody in the company actually knows what that vision is. So the level of communication is just typically bad. There's so many ways where communication can be easy, you know, voicemails, internal newsletters, websites, you know, you name it. But there's no point if you're wanting to grow a company and keeping the vision a secret from everybody who's in the company, because they're the ones who are actually going to deliver it for you. But somehow it just seems to be 100% of the time, that's what we're seeing. I don't know if that rings true to you and the companies that you've seen.
It does. And actually, one of the most successful online companies that I have seen in a while has an internal business wiki. So they're, from the top down, they can access this wiki and they know what's going on at all times, and they can make suggestions. They can, if they've got a grievance, it's a safe place to put it, and these things are addressed. So there's a lot of transparency, which helps them pivot as needed.
Look, absolutely. I'll almost guarantee you the best ideas for how the company needs to behave and act and the tasks that it needs to do will not come from the owner. It'll come from the people who are in it. So if you
and
keep it a
secret,
you're missing
that's
out
what she
on
said,
all the talent.
Yeah. She said a lot of the best ideas came from the people who work for her.
Well, I'd even correct that and say the best ideas come from the people who work in the team.
Mm, gotcha.
I have the view that an organizational chart needs to be drawn upside down. Because if you consider the most important part of a company is generally the clients. So you're there to support clients in doing what they want to do. So if you can make them happy, then they will in turn make you happy by paying you, and therefore you've got a business. So the people who deal directly with clients, you know, if you just draw that organization, client is at the top, all the people who work, you know, in that direct client facing, their job is to support the client. So supervisors and team leaders' job is to support the team to give them what they need in order to make sure the client gets what they need. End of story. The manager's job is to make sure the team leaders get everything they need to make sure their teams do a great job and to keep everybody in senior management out of their way. So they've got like a double facing role. They look up and down. And then the senior guy, their job is just to make sure everybody in the whole, you know, business is pointed in the same direction and they're focused on what the client wants. Now, every time you see an org chart drawn the other way around, because it means that everybody is looking towards the boss with their, I'll be nice, but their bottom is facing the customer.
Right, I understand.
And so that's just completely arse about. So, again, this is where ego sort of comes in. You know, if you team leaders and supervisors and managers, their ego needs to be in check. Their job is to support their team. That's it. They've got no other job. Whereas that's not how a lot of companies work. And it is pleasing to go into a firm and see that it's done wrong, because it can be fixed really quick. And you can buy a company cheaper if they're not doing it correctly, but they're still making a profit, because you know you can change that really quickly. All you've got to do is just, you know, re-educate the rest of the team as to, hey, this is your real role in the company, and that's how you'll be judged, and that's how you'll be rewarded, incented. Go, and you'll find that the people who deal directly with customers will be really happy really quick, and the customers will realize it really fast. And off you go.
So I'm guessing, just from listening to you talk about this, that when you go in and you take over a company or purchase the company, not take over, but, and I know that there's a lot of angst when a company is sold. Oh, geez, are we going to lose our jobs? What's going to happen? I'm guessing that once you get in there and explain that you're going to reverse procedures or implement new procedures, that a lot of that angst dissipates and they start putting their best foot forward instead of just going, I'm out of here, I'm looking for a new job. Do you find that's what's happening?
Look, it's always a trying time for everybody.
I can imagine.
There's no question.
Right.
But one of the fastest things you can do is to sit down and listen. And it's like a discussion like I just had about org charts. And when you do, when you draw that up and say, look, this is what I think, and this is how we want to behave, and so I'm not that smart. At the end of the day, I'm going to come to you and say, well, you're the one who deal with the customer, so what do we need to do? I've got some ideas, but, you know, I'm pretty fast. So if you just tell me what you think you need, then, you know what, we'll just give it a go. We'll try it and see what happens. And if you do that really quickly and you do exactly that, you let them try, and you'll see that results will come really quick. And then that message gets around the company faster than you could ever communicate to everybody, even if you send a reply or email. I tell you, word of mouth goes really fast in most companies.
Oh, yes, that jungle drum. We all hear it.
Yeah. We're not talking about a three-person company here. These are sort of the bigger ones. But you know, listen to your staff and actually, you know, figure out, well, what do they think they need to do a better job? Because they come to work to do a good job. That's my fundamental belief. People aren't stupid.
No, whereas they don't want to go in there and just watch time. They want to do it. Yeah, they actually want to provide real value because, I mean, look, if you get up every morning and you go about your day and you're just watching the clock all day, you're killing yourself. You're killing your heart, your soul. I mean, this is not what you're meant to do.
Yeah. I mean, and you're an expert at VAs. I mean, VAs in the Philippines are some of the most loyal people you will ever come across. And so if you get them engaged on a particular project, they will just bend over backwards to make sure that they deliver. Now, if they don't deliver to the way you want, that's not their fault. That's your fault. So just, you know, learn to work, you know, learn to be more systematic, explain more, talk more, whatever. But that loyalty is just inbred. And fundamentally, I think that's the same the world over. You could have a business in Israel, you know, in the Middle East, in Europe, in, you know, Slovenia, wherever. That's just how people are. It's crazy that bosses seem to think that that's not how things work. You know, they need to listen to me. I know best. See, those companies that have bosses like that are easy to buy because they're not valued that high.
I can imagine. And the thing with the virtual assistance industry, and I've learned this through trial and error, I learned it actually fairly quickly. And I mentioned it earlier, when you know, kind of bring everybody into your vision and ask for their input, that really helps. But the thing is, I've made it a point, because I am a techie nerd, I have a computer science degree and everything, I never ask anybody on my team to do something that I can't already do, because I already speak that language. I already speak that tech language. I know what I'm asking for. I'm not just handing it off and going, oh, by the way, figure out what you think I want and deliver something, and then I berate you because it's not at all what I wanted. So I would strongly suggest that when you're working with a VA, whether they're in America or Singapore, the Philippines, wherever they are, that you educate yourself on what you're asking them to do, and that you're able to say, okay, this is what needs to happen. I'd like your input, but this is the end result. And if you work from that outcome, I find it's a lot easier to get them on board.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. Look, I think as the company gets bigger, there will be a point where you won't know how to do something that has to be done in the company.
Oh, yeah.
And that there's where, you know, you just trust that you've got the right people on board. And off you go. There's certainly things that we do in our firm that you know, I'm not fully across. Here's a different perspective. In our firm, the two of us run most of the activities. One of us is more external facing, and one of us is more internal facing. And if you think of Dell and Microsoft and pretty much most major companies, that's kind of how things work. You know, there's not one CEO, there's really a couple of guys, girls that are involved. And internal, external is a good way to think of it. The external people tend to go off and focus on how they can create network relationships and you know, partner up with other people in order to, you know, have those businesses promote this business. And it's not only sales and business development, but it's just they're spending more time not thinking about how the company runs, but how to grow the business forward. The internal person's role is to make sure that the business actually works. And so all the bits and pieces in the company are doing what they need in order to be able to support the mission and the vision of the company. And again, pretty much to a T, the businesses that we see that are available don't do that. Kind of have one person that's running things, and they tend to be more internal, not external. And so to us, that's, again, that's a good thing. Remember, everything I'm saying, you need to flip 180 degrees because I'm looking at it from the perspective of if we were to buy it, I want to buy it cheap because I'm looking for the things that are already wrong that can be fixed really quickly. So if the CEO is very internal focused and they're still making a profit, then it's going to be very easy to fix by having somebody focus on the external and start using the relationships. Because business is a team sport, not an individual sport. And if you can, you know, start using that team thinking, you will grow that business really quickly. But you still need that person who's internal focused to make sure all the bits and pieces don't break on the way through.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Murray, do you have a case study that you can share with us, like something recent that you've put together?
The most recent thing that we're doing as we speak, and it's not fully done yet, is to stitch two BPO companies and a managed services company together in order to provide a platform for two other companies that we've got in the portfolio that need help. So I come from outsourcing. The world of outsourcing, and if you're in VAs, you're kind of doing the VA thing is like out tasking, whereas outsourcing is probably when you're outsourcing the entire process, you know, like your entire administration department or your entire accounting department is being done by some other company. So I've sort of come from that world where it's just cheaper and easier to get the right people in the right country to go do those things for you when you, wherever you are, let's just use the example, you know, let's say we're in downtown Dallas in Texas. So the average wage is going to be, you know, probably $70,000 in a company. Maybe it's a little bit of an oil company. And so the accounting department, it may just be simpler to get half of that work done by somebody who's overseas in a different country, has exactly the same skills, but their wage is half. That's probably a simple way to look at it. So that's kind of how the outsourcing world has kind of worked. They're more efficient, number one, and generally they're cheaper, number two. And so coming from that world, I know that that's how outsourcers think. Their job is to have the right staff in the right place, have the right processes that are more efficient than the company that you're becoming, you know, the customer that you're about to deal with. And so as a private equity business, we've said, you know what, let's just skip the steps and let's just form our own internal group where we know we will use them all the time because it's like having 1,000 VAs at your fingertips, already trained on all these activities. So any company that we acquire into the portfolio will immediately be forced to use this group of people, which immediately lowers the cost of their operation, which makes them more profitable straight away. And so once they're more profitable, they've got more cash to go spend on externally selling what they do to others. So that's kind of a high-level case study, but it's actually something we're doing right now.
So what happens? I mean, I'm a little bit confused in my own brain here, so hang in there with me. But so when you buy these companies, I'm guessing that the person at the top or the two people at the top or whoever owned the company, are they gone or do they remain part of the company? What happens with them?
It depends.
I thought maybe it might. Yeah. That's why I was stuttering. It's like I can see cases where they would stay put.
Yeah, most of the time it's a stay put. Our role is to be more a board level than an actual in the company itself.
Gotcha.
I'm personally inside of one of the companies now in order to get it going, but it's a bigger play. So there's more things that could go wrong. So it's better that I'm in it, not at a board level. But, you know, it depends. Sometimes the CEO is the problem. The founder is the problem. But generally, you know, we're not looking to be aggressive and to upset everybody. At the end of the day, we're a friendly investor. And so the CEO, we might just say to the CEO, and we've definitely done it on one company that I know of, to say, look, you know, you've done a great job to get it to this point, but you know what? You're an internal guy. We need an external guy to grow this business. So if we throw some investment in, let's just go and hire a guy or, you know, a person who can be externally focused, already maybe has a network that can immediately, you know, double the sales. And you stay focused on, you know, growing the business because you've got it to, say, 400 staff. Well, it's probably going to be 2,000 staff in the next 2 years. So you make sure that doesn't break. And so, this is before we've even made the investment. They've gone, you know what, I'd be happy to do that. I'd be much happier to continue to focus on that. And therefore, everyone's friendly. We're talking about it. If the guy said, you know what, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard of, you guys, you know, we don't really want your money, then we'd say, thanks very much, see you later. So, yeah, sometimes the people who are running the company just need a bit of a jolt. Because let's face it, the reason that they're getting the performance they're getting now is because of the skills and their performance they have now. So if you want to change it, something has to change, and it's generally at the top.
Well, that makes sense. So when you're looking at businesses...
And the good news is even at a small business, you know, companies that have got two staff, the problem is the owner, pretty much always. And that may be a harsh thing to kind of turn around, but... you know, a company is a product of the owner. And
it's
the owner's thinking that you know, if you aren't getting the result that you want, then change your thinking. It's kind
of actions.
Simple. Yeah, absolutely. But most people don't change their actions because they haven't thought of it. So take time out to think of it.
Exactly. It's surprising what we don't know. And I say this all the time. We don't know what we don't know. Sometimes the simplest idea will drop into my head because of something somebody said on an offhand, you know, comment. And I'm like, well, duh. And you do the head slap and go, well, you know, of course I should have known that. We don't know what we don't know. We should always be on the out, you know, looking out for new ideas and fresh ways of doing things. It's pretty amazing what we don't know.
Oh, man, I learn something. I learn stuff every single day. And it could come from, you know, I could be at a street vendor who's selling food here in Singapore for $4, you know, for, a main meal, beautiful duck rice, which is my favorite lately, for $4. And the way that vendor deals with you as an individual, just kind of, I sit there and think, wow, that guy is really smart. He's got a really good attitude around customer service, and it just causes you to think of things differently. So I learn stuff every single day.
Oh, yeah. You have to be open to it. I do, too. And, I mean, it'll just drop into your head just as an off thing. You'll hear it out of the corner of your left brain, if you will. And all of a sudden you're like, huh. And this whole train of thought goes off. So always be open to something. So you mentioned, you know, just a company with two people. I actually own a company with two people. And we're building and we're growing, but we are building it to sell it, which is the first time I've done this, I'll be very frank. So it's, I really wanted to talk with you because I wanted some insight on what it is that we need to do. So if you would, you know, people like me who are a very small company starting out, but we will eventually build it up and, you know, move it to someone who can take it and run with it. So what are the steps that people like me should take? I mean, you've given us a few. Okay. Organizational chart. I wrote that down. I understand that. But what would you tell very small businesses about how to, you know, start from the beginning and do it correctly?
I would definitely take the time. You need to be systematic. And there's not many companies that can't be systematic. I mean, creative things like, you know, graphic arts and stuff like that, you could argue that perhaps that can't be that systemized. But everything around how you give the graphic artist the work and how they, once the work is done, it gets back into the system, that completely systemized. So first thing I would do is go and blueprint the company. So that is basically go and brain dump all of the things that happen in this company. And it might, you know, I would expect to see 200 to 300 discrete activities, starting at a high level. You know, what are all the administrative things? What are all the procurement things? What are all the selling things? What are all the marketing things? What are all the, if you're into manufacturing or whether you're, you know, the actual producing of whatever you're doing, you know, what are the manufacturing steps? And then drill down and be discreetly writing down what is everything that actually has to happen. And then do I have a system for every one of those steps? And if you can get to that point, and that may take 6 months, then you are going to have something that is, you've got material to train people. You've got stuff to show if something breaks or something is not done correctly, you can go back to the system and fix it, change the system first. Because generally anything that happens that's not the outcome you desire is a system problem, not a person problem. Because most people want to blame people. It's like, oh, you know, you made that mistake. Well, if there's no system that they were following, then that's a system problem. So go fix that, update it. If you've just do that by yourself, then you've probably tripled the value of the company and you don't even know it. Purely because you've now got material that you can train other people to scale what you're doing. Now, that said, don't spend 100% of your time just doing that, right? Because you still need to get out there and sell stuff. And at the end of the day, as the owner, spend more time selling than you do on everything else, and you'll probably you know, walk out with more money. And it took me a while to figure out that selling is everything. But selling doesn't have to be what people make it out to be. You know, selling is just making it easy for people to buy. So, you know, making sure that, you know, if somebody is interested in your stuff, that there's material that they can read. You know, the website makes sense. It's easy to navigate. That there's brochures that make sense, and that's easy. And if they want to talk to somebody, it's easy to find a phone number. A lot of these little things, you know, I'm saying that just seem to be so complicated for most companies, when just make it easy for people to talk to you. I find that the more that you can simply talk to people, the more you'll sell. And you don't have to be hard sales or anything of that nature. You just need to be human. If people want what you've got, then just make it easy and, you know, you'll just simply make more sales. So do those two things, and you're well underway.
Do you know what I have found? And I'm sure, and something you said just, you know, brought this straight into my mind, is that so many companies, large companies in particular, simply do not want to talk to a real person. You can't find a phone number. You can't connect with them. It's incredibly frustrating. And eventually what I find, me, because I carry a grudge, I think a lot of people do, we're like, I didn't like that, I'm going to remember that. The first time we find an alternative company. you know, an alternative product. We're like, you don't want to talk to me? You don't want to find out what's going on, that this is a real problem? I'm out of here. Do you find that that's a big problem with some of these companies, that they are simply unavailable to their public, if you will?
Look, the answer is yes. Some companies just, you know, in spite of what they're doing, they're making a fortune, and they're difficult to deal with. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Google, PayPal, and Facebook.
That's exactly
right. Are just
very
difficult to deal with.
And those were the ones.
However,
I was thinking
they're making
of.
A
Amazon
fortune.
Amazon too.
They're making a fortune. Well, actually, let's talk Amazon. Because Amazon bought a company called Zappos. And Zappos was based in Henderson in Las Vegas. And Zappos prides themselves on being very easy to deal with. And that's how they grew so fast. You know, people could just ring them up. And the way that they rewarded their sales staff on the phone is they basically said, you could talk to a customer as long as you want. Just, you know, make sure the customer understands what we're, you know, the whole transaction. Don't confuse them. You can disagree with them, agree with them, but just don't confuse them. And as a result, their sales just, you know, they were $1 billion in sales in about 2 years. So Amazon bought them, which is really good. However, Amazon is really difficult to deal with. And so I would think that at some point in the future, Amazon is probably not going to be as famous as it is today, unless that something changes. But I think companies that are easy to deal with, people just will just respond to better over time. So, hey, and I've been wrong in the past, so don't quote me on this one. Some of those companies, you know, they're obviously making so much money, they just don't really care. So if we wind it back to a company that's probably, you know, 10-person company, then just be easy to deal with and you'll sell more.
Exactly.
I've never known that to be not true.
Well, you know, to go back to the Zappos thing, I was an early Zappos shopper. I loved Zappos. And then
you're a shoe person, are you?
You ought to see, it looks like Nordstrom's threw up in my closet. It's embarrassing. But, you know, once Amazon took over, I'm not a Zappos customer anymore. I'm just not.
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it? It's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, their corporate culture disappeared. Everything, you know, and, you know, the owner of the company wrote that great book, and all of a sudden, gone. Just gone. So I was sad to see them absorbed into Amazon. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm an Amazon Prime member. I'm a total introvert. So, and I've always said, the moment that Amazon can deliver 30 pounds of live crawfish to my door and a head of lettuce, I'll sell my car. I mean, I really don't like shopping, and I really don't like being out in public. So that being said, though, I think that Amazon is getting a little bit too big, and they're starting to scare me, to be honest with you, with a lot of the stuff they're coming up with. But we'll see where they go. But I hate dealing with them. If I have any kind of customer complaint, if you will, oh, man, and that's a problem for me. It's like, you know, I spend a lot of money with you, but you can't put a person on the phone with me. I'm not liking that.
It's, I don't know if you have the same thing in the US as we do in, you know, Australia, and they do in Singapore and Hong Kong, is that if you're a bank customer, you've been with the bank, say, you know, 5 or 10 years, and maybe you have a mortgage with the bank, and the mortgage, let's say the rate with the mortgage was, say, 4.5%. Well, and all you see advertised in your email and on TV is 3.95% for new customers. And you sit and scratch your head and thinking, hold on a second, I've been with you for how long? And you're not giving me the best rate? You're giving brand new customers a better rate? Sometimes marketing people need to sort of, you know, get a slap in the head as to, you know, the customers that you want are the ones you've got now and you want to keep them. I mean, a great mentor of mine, Keith Cunningham, you know, he's got this list of questions. It's just unbelievable questions to sit and ponder. One of them is, if you never lost every customer that you've ever had, what would your business look like? And if you sit
Good
and think
question.
Of that, it's like, holy crap, you know, if I just...
Yeah.
So what can you do to not lose customers? Again, this is what business owners should be doing. They should be thinking of decent questions, and spend, you know, good quality time thinking. That's how you grow a business. Not sitting there, right, you know, arms in, trying to do all the work and tell everyone, you know, how to do it.
Exactly. And to go back to what you were just talking about, with the banking, AT&T, you know, Slimco, all of anything like that, Cox Communications. I recently had to call AT&T, and I needed a hotspot. My internet had been failing, and, you know, I needed a hotspot on my phone. Well, they were going to charge me for that, and I've been a customer of theirs for a long time. Fortunately, I got a guy, a, you know, customer service person who said, well, let me take a look at your account. And he recognized that I'd been a long time. He said, you know what we can do? We can switch you to a completely different account. It will give you more, you know, download speed. It'll give you whatever it was. And it's going to cost me about $50 a month less. And part of me was going, oh, good, let's do that. This is great. The other part of me, and this speaks to what you were just saying, was why didn't they already offer this? I have been a customer for years. Why didn't they go, hey, Denise, we want to reward your loyalty. Thank you so much for being a great customer. We are going to voluntarily put you in a different plan. We'll let you choose your plan if you want, but it's going to cost you less and you're going to get more bang for the buck. That never happens. You have to go to them, register a complaint, or ask a question, and then they may find a way around it. They may not. I just happened to get lucky that day, I think. And that's always been a big bugaboo with me. If, like you said, if they're, you know, giving new customers this rate, why in the world are they not giving you the same rate? That makes no sense at all to me. None.
But see how easy it is to compete against big companies?
Yes. I'm seeing exactly where you're going with this. Yeah, absolutely. But is there a reason why they don't want to do this, or just they figure that we're too stupid to ask? What's the deal with that?
Look, I don't know the answer. I mean, you know, you can't legislate against stupidity, but I think
we try.
I think over. Look, actually, you guys are doing a good job so far. I mean, let's not go politics, but it doesn't look good globally. And it's not to do with parties either. It's just the entire country is doesn't look good at the moment. But hey, let's not go there. But the I think generally companies, you know, I think when you get to more than three people in a company, you have company politics. It's neither good nor bad. That's just what happens. And so over time, you know, you get to a 100-person company, a 200-person company, and there's a lot of people in there that are beavering away to organize their own personal agenda. And they kind of, it may not align with the company agenda. And over time, if the owner isn't on top of everything that's going on, then you just get this, you get like government, what you see in government, you know, you just get departments that are competing with each other. And you think, what, you know, you guys are there to support, you know, us as citizens, and yet you're trying to, one department is doing this and another department is crossing over them and doing something else. And you think, you know, in what world has that ever worked in history? But that's not how those people think. They don't think. They're just doing it because they, you know, want to come to work and do something that they think makes a difference. It just is not aligned with what everybody else is thinking.
That's myopic at best. Yeah, I can well imagine. You had said something about your book, The $1 Million Payday.
Yeah, look, I put a bunch of ideas together and put it in a book. It's available on Amazon, but you know, for your anyone who's listening, if you go to the number one mpayday.com, so 1mpayday.com, you can just put in your email address and download it for free. It's a PDF file, and nobody's going to bombard you with sales, you know, or anything like that. You know, we're not that type of company. But if anybody who's listening has a business that they're thinking of, you know, they might have some questions about, hey, you know, what could I do with this thing? You know, could I sell it? I'm happy, you know, if I've got time, I'm happy to provide some answers, and so that's what we've got. Our emails are simply not complicated. There's a couple of videos that I explain some of the things that are in the book. But you know, at the end of the day, it was written to be able to help more businesses see the light of day by realizing that, you know what, if I just set my business up to sell first, it's probably not that complicated to get $1 million from a company. And you don't need to be really a big business to do that. And so that's what it is. And so some people have said it's okay. Others have said, oh, my God, what a boring read. But I then quickly boot them off the email list.
I'm going to definitely download that as soon as we're done. Listen, we are running out of time. We've only got about 3 more minutes. I want to ask you, and I like to ask this to a lot of people, because I find that having success rituals in my life really is helpful. I have morning success rituals, and I guess that's the best way to put it. You know, things that I just do every day. A lot of it includes gratitude. Some of it is me going outside. And I have these wonderful pecan trees in my backyard. And I have this gorgeous backyard. It kind of looks like a secret garden. But part of my ritual is every morning to go out barefoot, get underneath those pecan trees, and it doesn't matter if it's muddy like it is right now, dig my toes into the earth and kind of ground myself to the earth. So what success rituals do you have that you just can't start your day without?
Interestingly, that earthing is something I do after travel. So,
I travel a lot.
So, if you get on a plane, you know, you're into the ionosphere, you get a lot of gamma radiation, you get all this weird stuff going on up there, and then when you land, different time zone, best thing to do is exactly what you just said. You know, socks off, barefoot, out onto the grass, real earth and earth. Look, I don't really have success rituals in that way per se. What I do value highly is keeping in touch with a big network of people. I'm a collector of people. So everybody I meet, I find out, you know, what they do, what they're interested in, you know, how they work, and I do my best to keep in touch with them. And if I find things that I think, you know what, I'm talking to this particular person and, geez, I know a guy that does that or may well be interested in that, so I put them together. And I don't expect anything in return. I just say, you know what, I'm happy that we've done that. By just doing that, call it karmic, but things happen in a good way. So that's kind of, if I was to have anything, that's probably it. Is to constantly, you know, be interested in other people, finding out what they want, and then figure out how I can help them. And if I can,
I think
I do.
That's amazing.
Then, you know, at least have a red wine and, you know, ask them to pay, and then I'm happy.
There you go. Murray, where can people find you on the web? I know you mentioned the book. If you'll mention that one more time, and I think there's another website too.
Yeah, look, the number one, so 1M as in million, payday.com, 1mpayday.com, download the book. Our website is globalprivatepartners.com. I'm easily contactable through that website. And, you know, yes, it's in Hong Kong. My business partner's in Hong Kong. We're both Australians, oddly enough, but we've left Australia. I'm in Singapore. He's in Hong Kong. There's just more. There's more action, if you like, in Asia than there is in Australia right now. I think most people would realise if they've got a business in, you know, Louisiana or Missouri or wherever in the US, there's more action actually outside of where you generally are. And so that's what we've done. We've both moved and, you know, we're just very happy. Right now things are just screaming along, even though the world looks like it's, you know, coming to a grinding halt. But right now, things do not look like that from our perspective. So we're very happy, and I'm super happy to be able to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, I'm with you. But here's my observation, because I'm not a negative person at all, but I think I'm a realist. And the world always looks like it's grinding to a halt, so I just don't pay attention to it. you know, I take my pleasures where I can, I find my joy where I can, and I just keep on going on. And if the world ends tomorrow, I'm fine with that, because I've done the best I could do the day before. So that's, I think that's all you can do.
Well, there's probably one secret of mine. I don't watch the news. I don't watch TV.
I don't either. I cut cable years ago, and it's the healthiest thing I ever did.
You know, even not watching TV, I mean, I get so much news that are bombarded through my mobile phone and everything else that, look, you know, if something happens in the world, I know about it, but I just don't watch news because the media is just completely biased.
Insane. Let's just call them what they are. They're insane.
They are completely insane, and that doesn't help anybody, so, yeah.
No, it doesn't. Murray, thank you so much for being with me here today. It has been a true pleasure speaking with you. And as always the case, this podcast hour went way too fast. And I thank you for all of the wonderful tips and advice that you've shared with our audience. And I really appreciate you rescheduling after our kerfluffle yesterday.
No, look, my pleasure. I enjoyed it. Always enjoys having the chat, so.
Thank you so much. Well, today's episode was sponsored by my company, Your Office on the Web. If you're looking for full-on business creation services such as web development, virtual assistants, online business management, social media marketing, and honestly so much more, please visit yourofficeontheweb.com. And be sure to look for us on iTunes so you can hear this on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android, wherever you are. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio. And take us along on your success journey. Murray, again, thank you.
No, my pleasure. And good luck to everybody.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.